listening to Where the Evidence Leads. Apology for Science and Reason.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Where the Evidence Leads. This is your host, Marshall. And with me is...
Paul, and I'm from S is for Science at blogspot.com, and it's in the local Midwest Skeptics Group. How you doing, Marshall?
Pretty good, pretty good. Paul, you know, I just checked out your blogspot again. I had been neglectful to it for a while. And you did a really good spot on the evolution stuff that we went over on our last episode.
All right, thanks. Yeah, I haven't been doing too much. I've been trying to take care of my mom's property. My mom passed away in the springtime. So I've been trying to get the house taken care of and the probate and all that stuff, and that consumes a vast amount of your personal time. Trust me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So I've been doing that. So the blog, I've got a bunch of blogs I've been working on, but none of them I've actually followed through on. But I'll have another one after this one's over with, and I'll start posting regularly again.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, how do I sound? I've got a new Bluetooth headset that I'm using, and... kind of curious as to how it sounds on your end.
Well, it sounds a little bit like you're in a tunnel, just a little bit. A little bit of tunnel on this end. But then that could be my cheap speakers as well. Because I had to go back to my game headset because the microphone I bought broke and won't work. And I got to get it replaced. So I went back to my game headset. So that might be part of it as well.
I'm hoping that it's part of it. I've recorded with it, just tested it out, and I thought it sounded okay.
Well, you don't sound bad or anything like that. There's just, you're usually a little deeper, and there's a little bit of a background noise with it this time.
Oh, and is the background noise gone?
No, it's usually only when you're speaking. It's just a little bit of a not feedback, but almost an echo.
Okay.
But otherwise, right. You don't sound bad, so don't worry about it.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm stuck. I stepped on my last microphone, so it's no longer an option. So this is what I'm using. Got it for $13, not including tax, at a local Aldi's.
Sweet. Now this is a Bluetooth headset for just any audio, or is it for a USB port?
I had to buy, actually, the USB adapter so I could use it with my computer. But, I mean, it'll work with my phone. This headset will work with my phone right out of the box. But, like I said, I had to get the adapter for my computer. I spent like $40 for it.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. I've got a couple of Bluetooth adapters that I've used for my phone. Of course, they're all crappy, so I probably won't use them. But that might be a viable option. I could walk around the house.
It's very convenient. You know, I noticed that recording, that sometimes if you move around, you get this very inconsistent audio quality. If you're moving, if your mouth is moving away from the microphone, if you move too close to it, and some of our earlier shows, that kind of came through. So I'm hoping, I'm hoping that even if we have a bit of a trade-off in how I sound, if that echoing thing that you mentioned is still there, hopefully that will... still be better than and what we had dealt with in the past. That's the plan. If not, I'm going back to Aldi's to look for another microphone, which I don't think I'll find at Aldi's. But anyway,
go to Micro Center.
Where?
Micro.
Oh, Micro. Yeah. Micro Center's a good place. I go to Best Buy a lot.
Well, you prefer Best Buy. Yeah.
Micro Center's good too. I really like Micro Center.
I haven't been to the new one out there by the Legends. Have you been out there?
No. We have. I was just at the Legends, which is a local Kansas City mall that most of the listeners probably wouldn't know anything about. But
true.
It's a local mall. But no, I haven't been to that one. Been to the one here in Johnson County, Kansas.
Okay.
But I assume if you've been to one, you've probably been to all of them.
Been to all of them. Yeah.
So anyway, how's life with you?
It's like I say, other than being really busy, October is a very busy month for me, the wife, and our daughter. We do lots this time of the year. And then it's just for us, it's just a holiday blitz from now until New Year's Day. So we had the big, my daughter dressed up as Batman this year. Not Batgirl, Batman.
Batman.
And my wife made her an outstanding costume. She took an old Darth Vader costume, converted over to a Batman, and she had a plastic Batman face with the pointy ears and things. And so my wife made her a complete outfit, gloves, whole nine yards, and she ran around. We went out to that mall. We were talking about the Legends. We went trick-or-treating out there, went and seen a movie, went to several friends' house and went and trick-or-treated. And we were trick-or-treating last night till probably 9 o'clock. And wow. Talk about wiped out. She got a bag of candy. Oh, she got candy for the next year.
Yeah, you know, we had trick-or-treaters, but really, I think our last trick-or-treater came around 8. Nobody after that. Which was, I guess, good in a sense that the fewer trick-or-treaters, the more candy wife and I have.
Yeah. Well, we usually we don't get too many where we're at. We'll go over to some in-laws' house and we trick-or-treat in their neighborhood. And the kids were out in by the droves. It was really kind of fun. There was tons of kids out there, lots of people giving out candy. It was a really good night. My daughter was like, Halloween's the best ever. So
Halloween is. Halloween, I have to say, is our holiday, the holiday of non-believers or of pagans. Christians, to my experience, have kind of given up on Halloween.
Well, no, my daughter has a friend at her school. And she gets this. Well, my friend, I will not mention names, she says that they don't celebrate Halloween. I go, really? And she says, yeah, because she says it's the devil's holiday. And I don't know what that means, why the devil wants to do it, because it's a holiday for kids. I don't understand that. But and then my daughter, surprisingly, my daughter is quite a believer in God. Mm-hmm. My mother did a number on her, and we didn't realize how deep it had gone, because she was saying, and besides, God wouldn't let anything happen that was bad, so it can't be a bad holiday.
Yeah, God doesn't really have a good track record in that regard, but anyway, go ahead.
Exactly. But so it was kind of interesting. So we asked her, so, well, how did you do that? Well, I just told her that she was missing out and that she should put on a costume to go trick-or-treating, because it's just a lot of good fun for a bunch of kids. So I was kind of happy with her that she stood up to that and didn't fall for that bite. So,
I was
impressed with that.
Yeah, a lot of Christians in our area just are refusing for the same reasons, refusing to go trick or treating or celebrate Halloween, which is too bad because it was a holiday I really enjoyed as a kid.
Yeah,
and kind of still enjoy now. I mean, I like having the kids come by and handing them candy and seeing their costumes or all the festivities involved, and. You know, there's no longer any real religious pretense to it. At least there shouldn't be. The local Christians are like your daughter's friend said, are arguing that it's of the devil.
There's actually in this area right here, there is a very huge movement on that number, and then for those churches that aren't opposed to it, they're having what's called trunk or treat.
Yes.
Where you show up at the church parking lot, they give you a bunch of paraphernalia, and then you get to go trick-or-treating from trunk to trunk in the parking
lot. Lame.
Yeah, I kind of thought the same thing. I thought that's just a little sad myself. I wasn't too sure. We didn't go and do one. We got invited to several. We have quite a few religious friends that know my daughter within, you know, Girl Scouts and all that kind of stuff. And there is a number of churches and groups around here that are opposed to Halloween or feel that it should be a safer church only evening event type thing. So, but I haven't heard anything about the devil candy that we heard about last year. Have you heard anything about that?
Oh no, because that got mocked so mercilessly.
Yeah, I don't think they brought that one up this year.
No, how. What was it again? Someone from Pat Robertson's organization went online with this bizarre claim that Halloween candy had been blessed by demons or made something weird like that.
Yes, and so that if you even ate the candy at Halloween time, you had the chance of inviting a demon into your life. Yeah, that one there was just...
Yeah, Well,
but there's people that believe that. Well, they don't believe it, like, in, you know, but they fall for these corny gags that dragged out the superstition of this kind of holiday. Just, I mean, what happened to good old fashioned give me candy or I'm going to egg your house?
Exactly. That's what I used to do as a kid, egg their house. I mean, I'm learning that pretty much that anything that Christians describe as being of the devil is something that I normally really enjoy.
Yes.
So, exactly. Anyway. All right, well, let's get on to the topic of today's show.
Okay.
It's not all going to be about Halloween and microphones, unfortunately. I'm sure the listeners are disappointed to hear that. Today we have Eli Johnson on the show, who many of you probably know from the popular podcast Chariots of Iron. Eli with Lamar. I don't have to know Lamar's last name. You know, well,
no,
Lamar.
I don't. No,
I'm sure most people listening to the show have probably listened to Chariots of Iron on more than one occasion. It's an excellent podcast that I listen to. And we're very excited to have Eli, sans Lamar, today. And we're going to be talking about the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which, Paul, as you were telling me earlier, is not a conversation or a discussion that you've spent a lot of time on in the past, but it's something, it's been a bit of an obsession with me for the past 3 or 4 years. This notion that a lot of Christian apologists are convinced that they can prove, basically, just by reporting found in the gospel, that Jesus, as a matter of fact, died and rose and ascended to heaven.
Hmm.
Which I think is an absurd claim that the Bible is proof for its own claims. But it's one that a lot of Christian apologists, a lot of really famous, popular Christian apologists make on a regular basis. So
yes, I've heard it quite often.
So you, I, and Eli are going to be discussing a list of questions or commonly used apologetical arguments in favor of that line of argumentation. And we're going to be discussing whether or not those arguments have any real merit. So, without any further ado, I'm going to go get Eli on the phone and we're going to talk to him.
Okay.
All righty.
You caught me right in the middle of a game of Minecraft.
Oh! this is Eli, I presume.
Yes, this is Eli. How you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. This is Marshall, and we've got Paul with us.
How you doing, Eli?
Good. Paul, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right, and Marshall. Nice to meet you both. So you guys both sound alike. See, me and Lamar, one's got the lilting southern accent, so we're easy to tell apart.
Yeah, so we're a little harder to tell apart.
Well, we're both from Kansas, so I guess apparently we sound like we're from Kansas.
So Eli, you're in Portland, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I've got a cousin lives in Portland. I think southern portion, little bit out of town. He lives up there. Then a friend of mine lived up there for a number of years, got 3 or 4 degrees, and then left for Costa Rica. So last time I heard from him, he was in Costa Rica or something. I have no idea. But oh. So I'm familiar with the area. I've been there several times.
Yeah. I love beautiful. It here.
Yeah, beautiful weather.
Well, anyway, Eli, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're playing, what was it, Minecraft?
Minecraft.
How is that game? I've seen some videos on YouTube of that game. It looks like it could just suck hours out of your life.
It does.
If you gave it a chance.
The reason Chariots of Iron sucks so bad lately is because I've been playing Minecraft instead of working on the show.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't say that recently, but but anyway, all right. So we have you on the show because we're going to discuss some of the more popular, what I have deemed to be some of the more popular arguments presented by Christian apologists regarding the historicity of the resurrection.
Right.
A topic that I have a particular interest in, which Paul does not, though, but. I think it's a fascinating topic of discussion, and I was, as I was saying earlier, this whole notion that you could prove, and they would argue, prove beyond a reasonable doubt that something occurred that is acknowledged to be impossible, and that the evidence, the undeniable evidence for that claim is the claim itself.
Yeah, I've always found that amusing. I got your talking points in the email, and I just kind of had to chuckle to myself because it's something, you know, I've dealt with quite a bit in online debate. And I really wanted Lamar to be here to chime in. He's priorly engaged. But yeah, I've got plenty to say on that topic.
Oh, good. Excellent. Excellent.
A lot of snark and mocking, but that's kind
excellent.
Of my...
Excellent.
Well, it never hurts. Never hurts. So anyway, okay, I've got a list. I've actually, since I sent you that list, I think I've actually added a question to it. I can't believe I didn't include to begin with, but we'll get to that. It's question number 7. There are now 8 questions that are, or arguments that we are going to address.
All
I guess
right.
Actually 7 arguments and 1 just observation that I've made about the absurdity of Jesus having risen from death, still containing all the wounds he suffered during the process through which he, you know, that killed him.
Oh, right. I think that was in the copy you sent me today.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought that was funny. Zombie Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Literally.
I love zombie Jesus.
I mean, because, well, I guess we'll skip to that. one of the things about the resurrection that I always think was funny is, like I said, that Jesus came back to life with the wounds in his hands, with the wounds in his feet, with the gaping wound in his side. And,
yeah.
And just this notion that if that's how Jesus came back, you know, we're screwed. You know, you really want to die young and beautiful if you're going to come back looking like you did when you died.
Well, you want to die young and beautiful in a non-violent way.
Yes, in a very non-violent way. I mean, if you're lucky, someone will poison you.
Well, this goes back to a lot of the same philosophies that you can even go back to the Egyptians with this. One of the reasons for preserving the body was because in the afterlife, you wanted to be as good as you could be before you traveled over. Mm-hmm. And that was a come thing. And this was, you know, one of the things I think that allowed Christianity to get a hold in the later years was that kind of went against the standard practices that were going on at the time. So that kind of fits for that time period if you wanted to look backwards, because that would be shocking, because, you know, if you're going to be resurrected, you want to be in perfect condition. And if he came back to prove that, I see I have my wounds, so that could be a good selling point, I can see, from that point of view.
Like it's somehow more realistic if he comes back with the wounds.
Right, like opposed to the early Romero Dawn of the Dead, as opposed to the Dawn of the Dead that was made the second time. You know, the zombies were much faster, was much more scary, it was a much better zombie movie. So the zombie Christ is much better than the, you know, I'm going to rise and float to heaven in a big cloud. So,
but yeah, but the absurd thing is, and growing up as a Catholic, they kind of gave us this vision of that Jesus, even now, still has those wounds in his hands and his feet, and in heaven, sitting on the throne next to the Father, it still has those wounds. And I just thought it would be interesting if, what if instead of crucifixion, if the Jews had been allowed to stone Jesus or burn him at the stake? I mean, he would have been screwed for eternity.
Yeah.
Well, if you read some of the Talmudic and other Jewish documents, one of the claims that is used by apologists to point to the historicity of Jesus is that he was mentioned in a Jewish scripture, which said he was stoned.
Mm-hmm. And hung.
Yes, and hung.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like a 4th century? Or when was that?
4th century.
Yeah.
Or 5th century. Somewhere in there.
Somewhere well after the point that anyone... the person who wrote it would have actually known anything about Jesus, and probably was just a smear piece.
Very true.
Yeah. Probably based on nothing more than a Jew wanting to make Jesus look bad. But you're right. I have heard Christian apologists actually cite that as a historical document.
Yeah, well, and there's really no way to tell that it was the same person named Jesus.
No, there isn't. This guy was a magician or a sorcerer, and yeah. I can't remember exactly the name of the document, but I've come across it a couple times in Christian apologetics. Because I like to point to it again as a historical document mentioning Jesus, but really don't want you to read it. They kind of want you to take their word on it.
Well, they don't want you to read Josephus either.
No. So, all right. Well, we kind of jumped to that point first, but let's go to the first common argument that we hear a lot of apologists using. Well, maybe not a lot, but I hear Gary Habermas use it on a regular basis. And his argument is that there is a consensus among biblical scholars. Various Christian apologists argue that there exists a near unanimous consensus among biblical scholars that the resurrection accounts found in the Gospels are historical facts. Though the individual details may vary, the core message is found in each. That Jesus died, was placed in a tomb, rose from death, and eventually ascended into heaven. Does this consensus, Eli, does it serve as evidence of a historical basis for the resurrection, in your opinion?
In my opinion, no. When we look at the majority of biblical scholars, we have to understand that we're talking about a majority of Christians.
Mm-hmm.
A majority of biblical scholars are believing Christians at one extent of the spectrum or another. So,
yeah, a significant majority of them are Christians, although
it's like saying, a majority of UFO abductees believe UFOs are real.
Yes.
Well, you can also, just to argue the other side of that coin, you could also look at it this way. I mean, the majority of particle physicists, believe in the standard model. And then there is a large minority that believe in the string theory, but they're all physicists.
Mm-hmm.
They're all physicists, but let's talk about method here. Scientists use the scientific method. Anyone can call themselves a scholar. There's no governing body of what constitutes scholarship.
No, there's not. Except I think Habermas enjoys luxury when he employs this argument of handpicking who he considers a scholar. And that's how he comes to a near unanimous consensus, and he describes it as near unanimous.
Well, that's a very good point, because with science, you have a certain level of credibility you have to show before your opinion can be accounted for. You have to have a degree. Most of them have to have a postdoctorate degree. You have to have done some time on the subject, so you have you can have a pedigree that others can examine. So you're saying these scholars don't have that same pedigree.
And you have to be able to provide the goods. I mean,
okay.
You say has to be verifiable, has to be something that other people in that same field can replicate and examine and then say yay or nay to, which is obviously right. Not the case with biblical scholarship by any stretch of the imagination. And like Eli said earlier, the significant majority of biblical scholars are in fact Christians, but more than just being Christians, they are Christians whose very livelihood depends upon agreeing with the resurrection, the historicity of the resurrection. As Robert Price can tell you, it's very difficult to get a job as a biblical scholar if you don't agree that Jesus is God.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of an uphill battle, as he's told me in the past. So, so you really have a strong amount of bias among biblical scholars to basically that they have to say, yeah, Jesus did rise from the dead. And again, without saying that, not only do they risk losing their job, and a lot of them believe that they risk going to hell, being tortured eternally, they also face the risk of losing their family and a lot of their friends.
Hmm.
So it's a situation where consensus on a religious topic that is basically tied to your eternal salvation is really not a very scientific method of coming to a conclusion.
Now, I'm, of course, you guys have to bear with me here because I'm really poor when it comes to the Gospels or anything like that. I found the fun books to read were in the Old Testament, not the New Testament. But would you agree with that?
I would agree. There's like 250% more horse penis in the Old Testament.
Exactly.
Which is unfortunate. Exactly.
So, but doesn't, I think it, I'm gonna give you some, correct me here quickly, I think it was Mark or one of them that didn't have Christ ascending to heaven until a later amendment. The original manuscripts don't have like two or three verses or whatever it is at the end where Christ then floats up to heaven. They just come and find the tomb's empty, he's not there anywhere, and the story ends at that.
Well, right. No. The earliest drafts of Mark have the women approaching the tomb. Jesus tells them to go assemble the disciples, and the last line is pretty much that the women flee and tell no one.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. It does have the resurrection. But how anyone heard about it from the end of Mark's gospel, I don't know, because the ladies didn't tell anyone.
Right. Okay. Well, but, yeah, and I remember there was something odd about one of the endings of the stories.
Well, you're correct that the last 12 verses of the Gospel of Mark were added, I believe, in the 3rd or 4th century. That they have several earlier manuscripts that don't have that ending. And obviously, somebody at some point realized, you know, this is a really bad ending. You know, we need to juice this thing up. And, you know, they added the resurrection and... Well, they didn't add the resurrection, but they added a whole bunch of other details that really made it a little bit better of an ending.
Correct. Well, yeah. They get the whole, you know, you get to drink poison and
yes, and handle snakes and that kind of nonsense. That it's actually, and there are a lot of Pentecostals who would still be alive today if they hadn't added that those last 12 verses because. They die of snake handling on a regular basis.
I thought it was the Baptists that danced with the snakes. I didn't know it was Pentecostals.
I wouldn't be shocked to learn that Baptists do it as well. So anyway, all right. Did anyone have any more on that one?
Well, I do have one quick question. So the consensus of scholars is not a consensus. You can find a lot of the scholars disagree with it, or it is a consensus among scholars that he did rise from the dead and was floated up to heaven.
You will find a consensus, not a unanimous. I would not say it's a unanimous consensus, because obviously Robert Price is a biblical scholar, and he does not agree that the resurrection took place. So it is not a unanimous consensus. However, if you were to somehow control that experiment for religious belief, you're not going to have a very big sample group.
No.
And that's more of the point, is that you'll sample is inherently biased.
But you'll also find the same tendencies among scholars of other religions. Like, you'll certainly find that the mass majority of Quranic scholars will tell you that the Quran is obviously and undeniably the word of Allah.
Right, and you'll find that Quranic scholars all believe that Muhammad rode a winged horse.
And that there's absolutely no way it didn't happen.
Right.
That the evidence is there's just so much evidence of that it could not be true. I mean, it could not be true. So this is actually a tactic that, or a fact that you will find, I think even Hindus, among their scriptures, will say the same thing. Although Hindus are kind of a more diverse bunch.
Right. Well, I mean, will a majority of Buddhists deny that Siddhartha found Nirvana?
No, they would not.
No, they're not going to do that.
So I think you're asking the wrong. It's almost like you're asking the wrong group of people, in a strange way.
Yes, and unfortunately, they're typically the only ones who know anything about it. Though.
Well, from my point of view, it'd be simply asking. Polling a group of string theorists whether or not string theorists is true. String theory is true.
Right.
Exactly. If all you focus on is the ones who believe or are getting paid to do this. They're all going to say, absolutely, string theory is correct, and until you can prove me wrong, I'm right.
Get me a group of agnostic comparative religion professors and ask them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess would be the best sample group you could have.
Well, yeah. Of course, by definition, if they actually did believe it happened, they wouldn't be agnostic. But yeah, you're right. In some areas, consensus of scholars might be a legitimate tool for coming to the truth. But when it comes to historic or religious claims, it doesn't appear that way. At least
you need a field which relies on more objective data.
Yeah, verifiable, objective, not solely dependent upon 2,000-year-old documents. So,
correct.
All right, let's move on to the second argument that I find on a regular basis being used by a Christian apologist. If the resurrection didn't happen, then why aren't there any contemporary documents arguing against the resurrection? Why does there appear to be no effort to contradict the message of this new faith?
I would say there were, weren't there?
Actually, there were. But this is an argument I hear on a regular basis from Christian apologists.
Really?
Oh, yeah. A number one. If you ever read any of Lee Strobel's The Case for Christ, I think this particular argument's in there at least twice.
Let me say I read through it. I did not read it.
I read
through it when we did that piece on it, and I read through it.
No,
I went ahead and read the other one as well because I knew we were going to bring him up because basically it was copied from his work. Mm-hmm. And I really found Strobel's arguments to be almost childish. They were the kinds of things that you say. They were said in a very adult way. Don't get me wrong that way. You know, he's not going, nan, nanny, boo, boo, I'm right, you're wrong. But I felt his arguing style to be almost childish. You know, I thought it was very sad. But I don't remember this particular point because I really glazed through a lot of it. But
well, I can say that I know about the criticisms to the resurrection and other claims of Jesus' divinity that are contemporary the same way I know about Lee Strobel's A Case for Christ, and that I've read the works against it. I read Price's The Case Against the Case for Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And we know about criticisms of the Jesus claims from, I think Origen's Contra Celsum against mm-hmm. Celsus, where we don't have Celsus's original work, but we have Origen tearing it down.
Exactly. And we've got works from Irenaeus, Tertullian, Justin Martyr, and actually most of the canonical epistles are dealing with some form of heresy or anti-Christian arguments at some level or other. So, like, you're right. While we don't have the original literature that was developed to contradict the Christian faith or the Christian argument, we know they exist because the church fathers spent so much time refuting them.
Right, and that they don't exist tells you how effective the pogroms enacted by the church when it came to power were at eradicating that kind of literature.
Exactly, yes.
But let's also keep in mind some historical context here. Around the time that the resurrection was supposedly happen and the preceding couple of centuries when these documents were first being written and circulated, you had a populace that for the most part believed in magic. Resurrection stories were not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
So they have no reason to really doubt that Jesus was resurrected. We know lots of people who have been resurrected. Why is his resurrection special? Might be the question they would ask.
Well, and it wouldn't be something that would spark somebody's skeptic side, because it was just taken for granted. Yeah, this stuff happens. The same with walking on water. I've read a number of things that indicate that was a trick used by a lot of prophets and holy men, that they would be able to come up with ways where it would appear that they could walk on water. And
well, Christ is just basically an amalgamation of a lot of other stories of the time that accumulated into one mythical individual.
Hi, this is your host, Marshall. I'm interrupting here just to inform everybody that for some reason, my call recorder stopped recording at this point, and it took us about 10 minutes or so to figure that out. So we're going to resume in action. Just want to let everybody know, though, there's a 10-minute gap that might sound a little bit odd to everyone out there listening to this. We apologize for that, and we resume in action now. Hello? It'll take about...
Hey, everybody's here.
I don't know what... I'm not sure what happened there, because I could still hear you guys.
Yeah, it's a Bluetooth.
And I was like, those bastards keep talking over me. What the hell?
Excellent. My plan worked.
So I could hear you. You guys couldn't hear a word I was saying. So
I'll have to try that with Lamar sometime.
I don't know what was going on. So hopefully, I don't know how much, if we lost anything, I don't know at what point it stopped recording. I hope it just stopped recording. I'm going to go check.
Well, you, when you I know hung what? Up. I have CallGraph installed, and I forgot that I left it running, so I've got that whole conversation.
Okay. Sweet. And we might have it too. What am I looking for here? Documents. Pamela. And Skype, the recording program for Skype, it's got the weirdest name.
Really? Well, the one I use is called CallGraph, and it's awesome.
One I use is called Pamela.
Oh.
My wife's always like, who's this Pamela person you're talking to? Okay. I can't tell which one's which. Well, anyway, all right. If we need to get that from you, I'll let you know. All right. We'll figure out something. But hopefully we didn't lose too much. So, all right, you guys were finishing up the second argument about the February documents. And I think we can all agree that while we might not have in our hands today those documents, we know that they had to have existed because the Christian apologists of the time spent so much time contradicting them.
Correct.
And quoting them sometimes.
Correct. And that takes a minimal amount of scholarship to find that information, so I'm surprised it's getting quoted so much.
Exactly. So, all right, the third argument that we're going to address today, and again, like I said, these are all arguments that I hear from time to time from apologists that people take very seriously sometimes, that some people are just like think that these are just strokes of genius while I'm just rolling my eyes every single time I hear them. So the third one, the inerrancy of the Gospels. They couldn't be wrong, or they couldn't have been wrong when they were written, nor could they have been substantively altered since. And that's something I hear Craig argue, that we know that, A, the four Gospels were written by the individuals they're claimed to have been written by. More or less, we also know that the copies that we currently have are essentially what they wrote, maybe with a couple of grammatical alterations and typos here and there. But for the most part, we have verbatim what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Paul, John wrote.
That's so patently absurd.
No, I agree. But I hear this argument.
Any biblical scholar, even the ones who believe that Christ resurrected, know that the Gospels were not written by the names we put at the front of them.
Well, someone didn't tell Craig that. That's all I'm saying. Craig didn't get that email because he's still saying it.
He missed the big memo.
Well, and the inerrantists, the ones who are still saying that the Bible is the literal word of God, they're still saying that.
Well, of course.
They're going to. They have no choice.
Yeah, they have.
That's part of being an inerrantist.
Yeah, I mean, how could this be the inerrant word of God if they can't even get the name of the authors right, you know? So, yeah, I still hear that argument a lot. It goes on, they go on to say that they know that this is a fact, because obviously there's no way that four largely identical depictions of Jesus' ministry, death, and resurrection could have been written by four separate individuals in four separate locations by accident. We know it wasn't collusion on their part. So what they were writing had to have been based upon actual historical events. which is just silly.
Yeah, well, and that actually also goes against mainline biblical scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Mainline says that, at least to the synoptic gospels, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, Mark may have been original composition, but Matthew and Luke both used Mark and another source, known as the Q document, as a source. So there was collusion. We know at least for those three. John was written so much later, I'm sure they knew of at least one of the other ones, probably Luke.
Well, and as you know, Robert Price argues that John was actually written by Gnostic heretics and then later co-opted by the Orthodox Christians because it was so well written.
Could be.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you're right. Obviously, the potential for collusion is there, given the fact that the Gospel of Mark was probably written about a decade before Matthew or Luke, and the authors of those Gospels certainly would have had plenty of time to... they obviously based a lot of what they wrote on Mark.
Yeah, I think a decade is cutting it close. I think that it's been my opinion, reading several books on the subject, that when we tend to date documents...
Mm-hmm.
I think we date them a bit early. We always err on the side of earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We always give the earliest possible date it could have been written. Even when you hear, the earliest possible, and we give it the benefit of that doubt. But when we look at the earliest date for Mark, we're talking 60 CE. That's the date you'll hear thrown about. Well, 10 years later, you have the first or the second Jewish revolt going on. The 10 years preceding were a pretty tumultuous time in Jerusalem, and we know that Mark wasn't originally written in Jerusalem. It was written elsewhere in the Hellenized world. So, man, I personally like to give it about 10 years and think it was written probably shortly after the second Jewish revolt.
Yeah, that's my assumption as well. And of course, there's the distinct possibility that portions of the Gospel of Mark were written earlier and other portions of it were written later. We certainly have a lot of reason to believe that portions to each of the Gospels were added after the fact. Well, we know that for a fact with the last 12 verses of the Gospel of Mark. So right. For that reason alone, it's difficult to date the exact date that they were authored, since it appears that it could have been a process that went on for decades as people decided to add more and more to it.
Right. So what were the other arguments they had? Let's see. They said they couldn't have been colluded, and we've pretty much shown that they were colluded.
Yeah, word in a lot of areas, word for word.
Right. Yeah, they weren't written by the names on the front. And
Craig doesn't actually come up with this, but I got this out of one of his books, argues that the Gospels could not have, they were accurate when they were written and could not have been altered after that point, because altering the Gospels would have led to mass defections from Orthodox Christians outraged by the tampering.
Well, that's where I start to have a problem here. Don't a lot of these, even if that were the case, you know, you show up in church and all of a sudden your book's changed one from one Sunday to the next. I can see people getting upset. But we're talking about changes that have taken over large periods of time, long enough that you will have grown up with one document and never see it tampering. There could be generations between changes. That's my understanding of how it's been changed.
Well, and let's keep in mind that in the first, 300 years of Christianity, we have more Gospels that were not included than were.
Right.
So what about all those books?
Well, I know that's
a really good point.
Well, I know that Craig would argue that they're not even worth considering because they were clearly dishonest attempts. Craig does address that, but not in a very good manner, in my opinion. But when it comes to, first of all, with the altering of the Gospels, well, the fact that they've been altered is demonstrable. They have earlier manuscripts that don't contain things found in later manuscripts.
Correct.
So
women taken in adultery is a classic example.
Yes. Right. And, and, and various other things where they know that this wasn't in the second century version of this gospel, but it is in the fourth century version. So like I said, it's demonstrable that some changes have been made. But this notion, and Craig does make this, that any changing of the gospels would have led to mass defections. For starters, they may have. The early Christian church was kind of similar to Christian churches of today, very fractured. They seemed splintered from each other over numerous issues. One of them could have been because somebody was offended by an alteration to the Gospels. I mean, there's no reason to believe that this didn't happen.
You're right.
Well, the general population, a lot of them wouldn't have known anyway, because one, a lot of them wouldn't be able to read. Two, most of them wouldn't be able to actually get their hands on the documents to read them.
Exactly. Because
it's not like everybody had a Bible in the pew.
Yeah. They were very expensive to make.
Exactly.
I can't remember how much it cost to make a book back there, but papyrus and what was the other medium used for writing on?
Parchment.
Parchment. That stuff cost a fortune. And your average person didn't own any books because they were just too expensive. And like you said, the significant majority of people back then couldn't read. So they wouldn't have known if there was an alteration to the gospel or not.
Well, and not only that, but they would not, even if they did know how to read, they would have to know how to read the particular language it was written in.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there wasn't a lot of translations, but as time goes on, people's language changes, and it's like the Catholic Church and the original Latin Mass. I mean, you had to know Latin to, you know, to be able to read it and understand it.
Exactly. And
let's not forget that the big part of the Protestant Reformation was that the Martin Luther thought that people, as in the parishioners, should actually read the Bible.
Exactly.
The Catholic Church was against that.
Very much.
But in fact, they were burning people at the stake for thinking that was that was considered heresy.
Correct.
You know, being able to read the Bible in the vernacular of the region.
If you were not within the priesthood.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, what we have is a situation where you have a population where almost nobody could read, almost nobody owned a copy of the scriptures, and probably, and of that population, almost nobody owned two copies of the scriptures by which they could find the alteration. But Craig is convinced that this by itself was enough to prevent from any alterations from occurring.
No, Craig could convince people of the modern era that this would be credible because that's the reference they would have. If your favorite movie was, or like, let's take a modern example of this, a perfect example, especially for guys like me, A New Hope, Star Wars, 1976, excellent movie, broke ground records, was fantastic. He comes along, he didn't really like it because he didn't have the special effects, so he changes it. I went and seen it at midnight on the first showing of the remake of Star Wars. I enjoyed it, it was good, it was a lot of fun, but it's not the one I watch when I want to watch Star Wars. I didn't like the newer versions of the movies. I'm not a devotee of the cartoons on television. I don't like the changes he made. I like the original Star Wars. It's what I grew up with. I would leave that. And therefore, that's a perfect example that you can compare this with. You have Christians, if they come along and they started changing their Bibles, they start changing things, these people would be pulling their hair, having fits, on seizures. But they would have to know it was happening. And back then, they would not have known. That is a modern example. Well, and this is why I say that Glenn Craig or Strobel, whoever we're talking about here, is
a better parallel for somebody to imagine would be, let's say you saw Star Wars when it was released in 1977,
mm-hmm.
and you hadn't seen it in the intervening 25 years.
Yeah,
right.
Would you have been able to make an accurate comparison of the version you saw back in, what was that, 97, 96?
No. Yeah, something like that. No.
That would be a more accurate comparison to what these people probably would have been.
experiencing if a change had been made in their scriptures.
Right, but the example they're using is something that is like what I'm talking about. This would lead to it. But what, like you're saying right there, the people that back then, they wouldn't know because the majority of the time, they probably wouldn't even really understand what was being said at the front of the church anyway. And back then, the majority of the churches were Catholic. There was, until Luther came along, there really wasn't any other Christian church out there. And like you guys were saying, nobody had their hands on a Bible. So this pretty much seems kind of lame.
Well, even, but if you look at the modern days today, if you look at today as well, study after study has revealed that Christians of this century don't know what the Bible says. And I saw one particular poll or study indicating that more people thought that Reverend Graham gave the Sermon on the Mount than Jesus.
Oh, more, my.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sweet.
No, I can't remember. I think that was a Pew from Pew Forum. But that study's been done. Those type of studies have been done numerous of times. And the fact of the matter is today, in an era where you have near about 95% literacy, virtually everyone in this country owns at least one copy of the Bible. And they still, and they still have no idea what it says, and still wouldn't notice an alteration to the Bible. So to claim that it couldn't have happened in an era where none of those things were true is absolutely silly.
Yes, it is. It's like I said earlier, it's borderline childish style arguing. Well, you're arguing for the audience you have. You're not arguing for facts. You're pandering and trying to lay out what they want to think. You're saying, well, these people are going to think this way, so I will use an argument that will feed that thinking. And that's all that is.
Right. Well, the argument from kind of incredulity that we kind of covered earlier is that, you know, why would people have believed the resurrection if it wasn't true, such a miraculous event? But once again, historical context. People back then, the majority did believe in magic, and resurrection stories were common. Once you take it back to the historical critical reading, you realize this is nothing special.
Exactly.
Yeah. And by a more modern-day comparison, take slavery, for example. If someone owned a slave here in the United States today, people would be horrified. But 400 years ago, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. Times change, and opinions...
1,000 years
ago. Yeah. So, yeah. All right, let's move on to the next argument.
All right.
And this is one that this is probably the one I hear the most, and it drives me absolutely crazy because it's been refuted so thoroughly on so many occasions that I can't believe people still make it. But it's, why would early Christians have willingly died for something they knew to be a lie? And I still hear this argument. And it begs a lot of questions, in my opinion. For instance, I would argue that the majority of Christian martyrs in the first one or two centuries honestly believed in the Christian theology they were adhering to.
Well, I also think that a lot of the Christians that were martyred didn't go willingly into their death.
Well, exactly. That's another point.
Okay. I mean, I seriously doubt if, I mean, of course, there's a lot of argument, and I tend to favor the side that says Christians weren't sacrificed to the lions in the Colosseum. There may have been Christians that were murdered or were being punished for being criminals by going to gladiatorial-type games, but Christians weren't rounded. I don't believe that Christians were rounded up in the streets and dragged into the Colosseum and fed to starving, hungry lions.
I believe Nero snapped at one point and actually did do that. But for the most part, those claims are exaggerated.
He didn't do that to Christians. He did that to people, and Christians were some of the people he was doing it to. Mm-hmm. They weren't rounded up because they were Christians. They were rounded up because they could be rounded up. And the Christians got fed into that whole thing because there was others that Nero was doing that to. It wasn't so much a Christian persecution as a, they're weak, I'm strong, I'm going to persecute whoever I can because I've had a little too much lead in my diet.
Yeah.
I feel this is just a really weak argument.
Twin Towers. What? People fly themselves into death for false beliefs all the time.
Right, but they don't know their beliefs are false. They believe they're true. So did the early Christian martyrs. We don't even have to go into whether or not they were martyred.
So they wouldn't be... Well, it's like, right, why would early Christians have willingly died for something they knew to be a lie? Well, if they thought it was a lie, they wouldn't be Christians.
Exactly. Well, not necessarily. I mean, like Peter and Paul almost certainly knew that they were lying.
I don't know that Paul did.
Oh, I suspect he did. I think he was just trying to get in on the game. That we'll never know for a fact, but yeah.
No, that sounds good. Well, I've also heard theories that Paul wrote all the books. That they were just all his stories he passed out to create the church.
I've heard stories that Paul actually wrote none of his own letters, but as far as let's just assume for a second that Peter and Paul knew that they were lying, for whatever reason. I mean, and it's something that's happened a lot. People lying about religion. Like you said, they certainly didn't, assuming that they were actually martyred, and the evidence for that claim is sketchy at best, that they were martyred. But assuming that they were, it's quite a stretch to say that they died for their faith. They may have died because of their faith.
That's my original point, is the people weren't walking out there willingly dying for their faith. They may have been being killed because they had a title over their head, but they weren't willingly being killed. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference. There's a huge difference there. And I'm sure lots of them said, okay, I'm not really Christian. Don't feed me the lions. But
didn't get written about.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Eli, you had something to say?
Oh, I'm done. Next.
Oh, okay. All right, well, I was just going to throw out there, by comparison, Mormons also make similar arguments regarding Joe Smith, that he was a martyr, ergo everything he said was true, because why would he have died for a faith that he made up? And the same could also be argued for Muhammad, who almost died on a number of occasions while spreading Islam. Why would he have done that if he knew it was a lie? The fact of the matter is at no point did Joe Smith or Muhammad willingly put themselves in a position where they knew they were going to die. So, all right, enough on that one. Again, and that's probably one I hear the most, and it just absolutely drives me crazy. Okay, and this is another one I hear a lot. What happened to the body of the crucified Jesus if he didn't rise from the dead? And they go on to say, assuming that Jesus was placed in a tomb, how did the disciples manage to remove the body if it was sealed and guarded? If the disciples didn't remove the body, then why didn't the local authorities place it on display to prove that Jesus was still dead?
That's making a lot of assumptions.
Okay, yeah. Well, I have two questions about the story, because I'm not familiar with the Gospels that well when it comes to the actual details. Weren't the women showing up to clean the body the next day, right?
It was on the Sunday. It was
they were going to show. They were showing up to clean the body, and it was just
They were showing up to mourn.
Okay, but it was just the two women, right?
Well, the numbers vary from gospel to gospel.
Right. Okay, and so was the tomb guarded?
That varies from gospel to gospel.
That varies from gospel to gospel. So we don't know that it was sealed and guarded. We don't know that it was sealed. So there's two points right there. Could it have been just like on The Simpsons and the ducks in the pond that they went to the wrong tomb? And he's still laying there? I mean, we've never found the supposed actual tomb.
There are many tombs which claim the title.
Right, but there's no body in any of them, so there's no control there. I can't believe this is an argument for proof.
Oh, it is. I hear it on a regular basis, actually. Well, Eli, did you have a take on it?
Aside from just the abject absurdity, is every empty tomb in history, evidence that the inhabitant that that tomb was built for has been resurrected. If not, then this is not evidence for a resurrection.
No, it's not. And of course, it assumes that Jesus' body ever found its way into a tomb in the first place,
assumes there was a historical figure named Jesus.
Yeah.
That did everything that was said in the Bible. The one that he was killed in the manor, that he was taken to the tomb, and that he was buried there.
Each of which are pretty significant assumptions that we're only granting for the sake of this particular discussion. But this whole notion that a group of 12 disciples couldn't have somehow removed the body from the tomb if they needed to, it's just silly. And then they rely very heavily on the content of the Gospel of Matthew, where that's the gospel that indicates that there were guards placed there the day after, and a seal was placed on the tomb.
Right, but I believe it's in Mark, the tomb's already open when they get there.
Yeah, one of them that was already open.
And the man who tells the women that Jesus is risen is not identified.
Right, no. That's supposed to be Jesus.
In later Gospels, he turns out to be one or maybe two angels.
He's angel. Okay. It was an angel.
Okay. Which seems to me that is a detail that you would probably be consistent about if it were actually true. That's just me.
A lot of the details, I love Bart Ehrman's, or I think, no. Maybe it was Ehrman. It's if you look at all the resurrection narratives, I mean, try and build a cohesive, take all the accounts, accounting for all the details in all four accounts, and try and make one cohesive narrative out of it. It cannot be done.
Cannot be done.
I think that was Bart Ehrman, because I remember reading something along those lines.
Yeah, you've got the Gospel of Luke that makes it appear that Jesus ascended to heaven the day of the resurrection somewhere just outside of Jerusalem, whereas other Gospels make it appear that they traveled to Galilee to meet up with Jesus, and he ascended to heaven weeks after his resurrection, where he remained in hiding. And those kind of contradictions, the resurrection stories are probably, if you were looking for contradictions in the Bible, the resurrection stories are probably where you really want to turn to.
They're the easiest place to find the contradictions and discontinuities, definitely.
Not that there aren't a lot of places in the Bible where you can find them, but certainly, yeah, the total lack of consistency from one tale, and these, like I said, these are not minor details. These are not, there were four doves on the cave instead of five or whatever. These are the number of angels or whether or not there were even angels present. Matthew, unlike the rest of the Gospels, indicates that the tomb was opened with an earthquake.
Yes, I remember that now.
Which yeah, none of the other Gospels...
It was like lightning or earthquake or something, and the stone moved.
Don't forget, the saints rise from the grave and walk the streets and were seen by many.
Yes, yes.
Which, amazing, Josephus makes no mention of in his histories.
Josephus recorded everything, but he didn't record that.
Yes.
Please.
Only the Gospel of Matthew, not even the other Gospels, finds that right. Mentioning.
Maybe it was only two or three saints, and they just thought they were gone for a long time.
I don't know. When Jerusalem turns into a Romero movie, I think yes. Somebody mentioned it.
Somebody's got to mention it outside of what was probably the third Gospel written.
Somebody's gonna write that and carve that in stone. You're going to have somebody break out get the little bird, and they're going to carve it out of stone like on the Flintstones. You're going to see that written somewhere.
I know that they didn't have Facebook back then, but somebody's going to record that somewhere in Jerusalem. It's basically,
well, this
OMG, goes... OMG, my yes. Grandfather is alive.
Exactly.
Then, just the notion that that doesn't get mentioned by anyone is such an absurdity. I think, honestly, that by itself, if there was only one instance of contradiction or absurdity in the Bible, that by itself would go a long way to just prove the Gospels to be less than authoritative text, in my opinion.
Well, it definitely blows the literalism out of the water.
Yes.
Well, okay, but this goes back. This is an argument for someone like me who doesn't really know the Gospels that well, mm-hmm. who doesn't knows the overview, kind of like the manger scene. I know the manger scene of the Christmas story, which is just an amalgamation of all the other stories kind of pooled together to make one real pretty scene. So someone like me who is not, if I wasn't a disbeliever, this would work on someone like me if I didn't really want to critically think about it. Well, what did happen to the body? Well, come on. It was guarded. All this stuff was going on. And then how come they didn't just run it through the street showing everybody, see, he's really dead? Well, one, I don't know that the Romans actually did that kind of stuff. But, I mean, this would work on someone who doesn't know.
Well, yeah.
Well, yeah. Usually, and this is kind of the odd thing, is there's lots of peculiarities about the Jesus story. And what the Romans typically did is if they strung somebody up on a pole, after they died, they left them there as a warning to others.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So that he's taken down at all is kind of strange.
Well, the idea behind that, well, the idea behind that was they were supposed to clean it up before Passover or somebody important was coming into town, and they didn't want these dead bodies hanging on the telephone
poles. I think it was Joseph, they say Joseph of Arimathea pleaded with Pontius to give him the body. I mean, it's certainly within the realm of conceivability. It doesn't seem like something that Pontius Pilate would have done. He wasn't exactly known for his kind.
But if Pontius had given Joseph that boon, then they wouldn't have taken the body out and paraded it.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, and it assumes that the Romans even cared that a small sect of Jews was saying that Jesus was alive again. You know?
Another very good point.
That anyone, you know, like it got back to Caesar, you know? Caesar, we need to inform you of this important fact. Peter is saying Jesus is alive again. Oh, get his body out. You know, nobody would have cared.
No, they would have gone, does he do it for parties? We can kill him and watch him come back up.
Well, and also another thing to consider when it comes to, for some reason, if they had decided to take his body out, we're talking about one of the more humid regions of the world where a human corpse is going to decay extremely rapidly. Over the course of 2 or 3 months, the face of Jesus probably would not have been recognizable to anyone who knew him. So, again, even if the Romans or the Jews had for some reason found it necessary to parade his body around, it would have just been a maggot-infested lump of flesh at that point.
He would have stinketh.
Yes. He certainly would not have been a convincing demonstration of the Jewish claims.
But let's look at this from a Roman perspective. You've got some minor rabble-rouser causing some trouble in the streets of Jerusalem. Is that even the kind of criminal you're going to bother to parade around the streets to show everyone he's dead?
No, absolutely not. I mean, nobody, certainly the Romans are not going to give a damn.
Well, they're not going to add any legitimacy to it either. They were far too smart for that. I prefer the theory that, although of all the theories I heard, the one I like, I'm not saying it's a good theory or it's plausible, but the one I liked the most was is they didn't really kill him. And the only reason I would buy this is because one of the ways you die while you're on the cross is your lungs fill with fluids because you can't get them out anymore. You have such a difficult time breathing. So not only is it exceptionally painful to be hanging there, you just slowly asphyxiate and drown. You get a high-speed pneumonia close to it. So by puncturing one of the lungs, it would have allowed a lot of the fluid to come out. Now, one of the side effects of this, though, is if it would have been a bloody mucousy fluid, which is also exactly what happens when your lungs fill full of fluids. You don't get like a nice clear water in your lungs. But the side effect of that is that's not a real good way to drain lungs. But
no.
it, it can happen because your lung isn't one big open sac. It's a bunch of little teeny tiny sacs, and each one works in conjunction. But it would have relieved the pressure because then one of the other side effects that happens when you're hung like that is your stomach becomes distended because your muscles can't hold your guts in where they're supposed to be, and your lungs will hang down lower. Well, by stabbing someone in the side, if you get them underneath the ribs, this will actually relieve the pressure and allow the lungs to actually move the way they're supposed to, and you would actually be able to start breathing again, and your blood would take the pressure off your heart, which would allow you to breathe a little, your heart to pump blood a little better, which would then start collecting the fluids off the lungs.
Now,
not saying that this is what actually happened. This is just one of those things, well, what if type scenarios. It would be... might be possible that he survived it, and yeah, but, he didn't really die.
But why? I mean, I've heard that theory put forth on a number of occasions. I just can't think of any reason why they would go through the charade of actually crucifying him and then taking him off before he died. And I certainly can't imagine anyone actually agreeing to be the person crucified and then stabbed in the side.
Well, I mean, I'm saying, like I say, this is not a I'm not saying it's plausible. I'm saying that there is a little bit of medical knowledge that you could use to say this is one of those bizarre cases where this might be something that happened. And he could have just been an ordinary criminal, okay, who was crucified and not the Savior. And the entire, you know, resurrection story was taken from someone who actually woke up a day later and wasn't dead, and then this spread, and someone said, well, it must have been Jesus, and, oh, well, of course, well, you know, and gone from there. And this could have added the seed for this story. It's just an out-there theory that's kind of fun to play with. I'm not saying exactly what happened.
It's actually not that out there. That theory was first popularized during the Enlightenment by a group of people who refer to themselves as Protestant rationalists who tried to keep to the literal reading of the Bible without invoking any miracles.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and they did a lot of logical massaging. Yes, yes. I know. I've read about them, and man, they're actually, some of the arguments they had are really kind of fun. They're actually fairly intelligent arguments. Not necessarily true, but they were, you know, it's, if anybody's ever read, I think it was Osmov's The Duck That Laid the Golden Egg. I don't know if it was Osmov or Clark, but one of them wrote this thing, you know, and it was actually we're going to present this idea out here that we have a duck who's actually laying golden eggs, and they go through all these things that would have to happen for this duck to actually be able to lay the egg, including a small piece of nuclear reactor inside the duck, the whole nine yards, and they go through this whole thing, and it was a lot of fun. It's never going to happen. But it was a lot of fun, and this is one of those things, and they were a lot like that.
Yes.
All right.
So, all right, move on to the next argument. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then why did early Christians focus their efforts in Jerusalem, where everybody would have known that they were lying? Again, this is one that I've heard from Craig, and I think other sources as well, that they would never have proselytized in Jerusalem, where it would have been known for a fact that Jesus had not risen from the dead.
Is there any evidence that proselytization was heavy in Jerusalem?
Well, we know it occurred. We know it occurred, but we also know that the Christian faith really took off when they took their efforts outside of Jerusalem.
Correct. That's kind of my point.
Yeah.
Christianity wasn't huge in Jerusalem. Otherwise, Bar Kokhba was going to have a hard time claiming his messiahship when he led the Jews for the second Jewish
exactly. War. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, but this is an argument that they're using. And again, this is like what Paul said. This is for the target audience are those possibly lapsing Christians who really don't know anything about history or the Gospels, but still want to believe. They're just needing that reason to continue believing, because it's a really dumb argument.
There's very little evidence that Christianity was very successful in Jerusalem. Otherwise, we would have earlier Jewish sources, I'm talking pre-4th century, contradicting it, and we don't. Which tells me that, that the Christians were not successful in Jerusalem. Probably part of the reason Peter took off.
Yeah, that's why he left Jerusalem. Well, I mean, there was this small Ebionite community about which not a lot is known, but there's also no reason to believe that they actually worshipped Jesus. But yeah, like you were saying, if the Christianity were to have relied upon the success of proselytization within Jerusalem, none of us would have heard of it right now. It does not appear to have been a successful endeavor on the part of the early Christians, and that's precisely why they took their efforts elsewhere, where they had a lot more success.
Amongst the diaspora Jews in Greece and Rome, and then, of course, the Gentiles, which, of course, was the big friction between formerly Jewish Christians and formerly Gentile Christians.
And that's one of the reasons they probably eliminated the requirement of circumcision.
Correct.
That's for a lot of people a deal breaker.
Would be.
Adult circumcision, it's not something I'm volunteering for.
Well, now, isn't this also partially refuted in the Bible itself? Because didn't Christ have to convince several of his followers that he was actually Christ? And that a lot of people that saw him didn't know who he was?
You mean after his resurrection?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, if he had a hard enough time convincing his core followers, you're going to have, and not everybody, I mean, it's not like you guys said earlier, it's not like they had Facebook back then. I mean, not everybody, you're going to hear the rumor mill, but how much credence is that going to give to everybody? And like you said, it's not so much the resurrection that was so amazing, it was the fact that it was him that was resurrected, and what really made him special for those people who weren't already followers of his.
Yeah.
So I think the Bible kind of gives you your evidence that that's just a lame argument to begin with.
There's something suspicious to me. There's always been something suspicious to me about what you were talking about, the fact that nobody recognized Jesus when they first met him.
Yeah.
That it took a while. I mean, like the guys who walked with Jesus to and from Emmaus didn't even notice the fact that he had gaping wounds in his hands and feet and had no idea who he was, even though they were devout followers of him. Right.
This leads right into your next point, the condition of his body. I mean, this is another one of those questions. It's like, well, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then why did our Christians focus their efforts on Jerusalem when everyone knew they were lying? We're arguing with modern people that have telephones, that have cell phones, that have high-tech computers in their hand they can get on the internet. And, everybody's just huge social network web. Everybody knows everything that goes on all the time in that type of environment. Of course, I guess you could make an argument back then there wasn't a lot of news, so anything interesting that did happen would spread quickly as well. So,
yeah, but not necessarily in the initial form that it started in.
Right, telephone game, yeah.
All right, let's move on to one last question, and then we're going to wrap this up.
Excellent.
All right. And this one I kind of added just right before we started the show, but I've heard it argued by Craig and other apologists. There were so many witnesses to the resurrected Jesus, how could they have all been wrong? Or were they all lying? And, of course, the accounts as to how many witnesses there were to the resurrected Jesus can only be found within the Bible. And that's an argument that's really begging the question, because if we already believed what the Bible had to say about the resurrection of Jesus, then we wouldn't be questioning it in the first place.
Yeah, the accounts vary dramatically on how many witnesses there were. That seems to be one thing they disagree on universally. Yeah. We don't know how many witnesses there were. And so, therefore, it's incredibly erroneous to assume that there were many witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
which to me undermines the entire argument itself.
Does the Bible give you an account?
Well, varying. Yeah, Paul indicates that there were over 500 people who witnessed it. But
the resurrection or the ascension?
I don't know if it was the ascension, but the resurrected Jesus.
The resurrected Jesus.
Right, Paul says.
Yes, in Corinthians.
The evangelist, the guy who's going out, his whole job is to try and convince other people to follow this faith.
Exactly, and that's the source they usually cite. And then they go on to say, see, 500 people saw him. How could they be wrong? Without even contemplating the possibility that that Paul just pulled that number out of his ass because he was trying to convince the people to believe what he wanted them to believe.
Right. Ask how many people were at Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally.
Exactly.
X touche.
Okay, so
I have a nice little theory that I've had for a very, very long time. I really haven't shared this too much to anybody, but you're both biblical scholars. So what if this whole thing was just a big con job to begin with? Jesus goes riding into the city. He knows he's going to be killed. He's telling all his disciples, this is my blood. This is my body. Woe is me. I'm going to go pray. While I'm praying, I poke myself in the eye with my finger. So I come back out and I look awful. And everybody says, oh, you poor guy, why are you doing this? He then goes and gets a shill. Okay. He gets some guy and he's not very bright. And he takes him in there and Jesus shaves and cuts his hair so they can't tell who he is. And he turns this guy in, right? And he gets the crap beat out of him, and he gets put up on the pole and killed, and then Jesus comes back afterwards, and nobody recognizes the guy. Or, even a better con, how about somebody just says, I am Jesus, and this is why nobody can recognize him, because he doesn't look like Jesus. You know, there's two cons right there that are simple, easy to perpetuate, and, you know, if what end it would lead to, wouldn't it? But just the whole thing right there can just be a simple con. Somebody conning somebody else for some reason.
And certainly within the realm of possibility. I think even simpler explanation is that Jesus didn't even exist. And
well, that's most likely. The
most of the stuff was a con job to begin with for reasons that I won't even speculate about.
Well, Constantine was the big one.
Yeah. But certainly Christianity existed before Constantine, but not in the form that we know it.
Yes, but reality TV existed before Jerry Springer. But after Jerry Springer, reality TV was a whole different animal.
That's true.
And Constantine would be the Jerry Springer of
And I absolutely agree with that. I think, Constantine redefined what Christianity was. Anyway, Eli, did you have anything else?
No, I think we pretty much covered it.
All right, I do too. So, all right, well, Eli,
I don't consider myself a biblical scholar. I'm just a wise-ass know-it-all.
Well, that's a biblical scholar right there.
All right.
And I wouldn't consider myself a biblical scholar, although I don't know exactly what the criteria you have to meet to be considered a biblical scholar would be.
I think I've read a book.
Can I send a check to Patriot University and get a certificate?
Yes, you can.
Excellent.
Or Liberty University.
I think it's $20. You can become a saint. I definitely want to become St. Paul.
All right. Well, Eli, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Anytime.
All righty. Well, and this has been another episode of Where the Evidence Leads. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
You're welcome, Marshall.